Up next, ancient cosmology, amazing stories. Laird Scranton back with us on Coast to Coast. Latest work is Seeking the Primordial. We will be back with him in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We are back. Laird Scranton with us, author of a series of books and other writings on ancient cosmology and language. These include articles published in the University of Chicago's Anthropological News Academic Journal, Temple University's Encyclopedia of African Religion. He's worked with Carmen Bolter on a documentary called The Pyramid Code as well, and he is back on Coast to Coast. Laird, welcome.
Hey, George. Thank you very much.
Looking forward to this. I love ancient cosmology because it makes you really wonder what the heck was going on during that time period, doesn't it?
Yeah, it sure does, yes.
You key in a lot on the Dogon tribe. Tell us about them, where they're located, and what's so mysterious, because they did spot the Sirius star system before we even knew about it.
That's right. Well, the Dogon are a modern African tribe. They're a priestly tribe, and they're located in Mali, which is in the hump, the northwest hump of Africa, and they are situated 8 hours' drive across desert from anything we'd consider to be modernly civilized, and their culture combines elements of at least three different ancient traditions. They have rituals of Judaism, they have civic practices of ancient Egypt, and they have cosmology, a symbolic cosmology that's a close match for Buddhism. And so they make a really good entry point, a really good starting point for trying to figure out what was going on with these symbols, you know, these archetype symbols.
And the Sirius star system, is it not? It's a binary star system, isn't it?
It is, and the Dogon knew about it. This is our first exposure to the Dogon, was finding out that this little tribe that had no technology knew about these two stars. You have a bright sun-like star, and then in the glare of that star, you've got a second little dwarf star that orbits with the brighter star. And the Dogon knew about the existence of both stars, and they knew the correct orbital period of 50 years for the two stars.
I had heard, I don't know if this is true, that when asked where they got their information, they pointed to the star.
There is a legend that they had done that with the French anthropologist. I'm not sure whether they actually pointed to the star or not, but there are lots of references in their mythology to the Sirius star as being important. But you have to really sort of get down to the bottom of it to understand what the real relationship is. The knee-jerk reaction is to think that maybe the teachers who gave them this knowledge supposedly had come from those stars.
I would think so. And what's your gut tell you? How did they know?
Well, they say, and the Buddhists say, part of what I do is I compare what different religions say about the same question.
And so, compare it, sure.
You get down to the bottom of it, and what they're saying is that somebody who understood lots of science, more science than we understand, taught this stuff to them in ancient times.
All right, so let's look at this tribe. We're talking about what time period?
Well, they're a modern-day tribe, but the symbolic elements, the myths and the symbols, are coming from an era of around 3000 B.C., about the time written language emerges. But the tradition itself dates much further back than that. It goes back to about 10,000 B.C. It starts in the era of Göbekli Tepe and the Fertile Crescent.
At what point did we know about the binary star?
We didn't know about it. Our scientists couldn't actually image it until around 1918.
And we saw it with what? Telescopes?
I think at first they inferred it. They can tell by wobbles and stars that there's got to be another body there. And it took quite a while before they were able to actually image it. And it takes special equipment to be able to do that, to be able to filter out the light in a way so you can see an object that's hidden by the glare.
Now, were the Dogons, were they the only ones that had this knowledge, or did other cultures or civilizations know about this too?
No, lots of other cultures did. I mean, one of the easy entry points into it is, in ancient Egyptian myth, you know that Isis, the goddess, represented the star, the bright star of Sirius. But to be able to say that, you're sort of tacitly playing a game. The game is, when I say goddess, you say star. Well, they also tell us that Isis had a dark sister named Nephthys. So the indication is there that even in ancient Egyptian times, they knew there were two stars there.
Without telescopes?
Without telescopes, because somebody who knew all about it told them.
That's right. That's what I would think. And probably charted everything out for them.
Yes, actually laid it out very, very nicely. The Egyptian hieroglyphic language actually spells a lot of it out if you know how to look at the glyphs right.
Now, why would a culture, let's say they came down here, why would they tell a primitive tribe about a binary star system? What's the value there?
Well, that's one of the million-dollar questions is what's the motivation behind an instructed system in the first place besides just altruism, you know, purely trying to help us out. But that's part of what this book is about, is getting down to what that bottom rationale is. And when we get to it, there's actually a very compelling motive. It's almost a heart-rending motive for why what the Dogon describe as a non-material universe was working cooperatively with our universe to try to help us establish structures for society.
Then what happened?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. The Buddhists say that their most sacred symbols came from a non-human source. The Dogon say that it came from a non-human source that was originally non-material. Now, we have two matching symbolic systems that were kept straight in two different languages for thousands of years. We can tell there's documentation for Buddhism that goes back around 400 BC. The Dogon information, you can see, goes back at least to 3000 BC. So two different groups kept all this knowledge straight for thousands of years independently of each other. Now, for them both to be telling us they got it from a non-human source, either they both misremembered that piece in the same way somehow,
mm-hmm.
or else they also remembered that piece correctly, and we have to allow the possibility there could have been some influence.
Do they echo anything that might be in the Bible as well, Genesis?
Yeah, a lot of the roots of the biblical stuff are in the same information. All the Jewish references pertain to the Jewish Bible, which is the Old Testament. So yeah, there are a lot of references that tie back and forth. Biblical stuff for me tends to be a little bit on the new side. I'm looking at 3000 BC and before, and the biblical references are almost 3000 years later than that.
Laird Scranton with us. His new book is Seeking the Primordial, Exploring Root Concepts of Cosmological Creation. Talk to us about some of the creation issues you talk about in the book.
Well, this all comes out of a philosophy called Samkhya. This is the underlying philosophy of all the traditions in India. It's the Vedic tradition, the Buddhist, and the Hindu traditions all come out of the same cosmological philosophy, and it was a companion piece to yoga. And this parallelism between the two, yoga is sort of the personal ascension side of it, and Samkhya is the cosmological, the universal ascension side of it. And that mindset, universes form in pairs, routinely form in pairs, in one non-material and one material. And according to Samkhya and according to the Dogon, we're the fourth of seven pairs of universes. And there's a cycle of energy that scrolls from the non-material side to the material side that's as essential to life in the universe as the water, natural water cycle is to life on the planet.
Hmm.
The natural water cycle is water evaporating from oceans to create clouds that then go up over the mountains, rain, and then the water flows back to the sea. Without that cycle of water, we wouldn't have any life. And the Dogon is saying that's the same thing is true about this energy between the universes.
Do the ancients talk about God the same way we have learned about God?
No, you can actually see a progression from the archaic forms of things to the more recent ancient forms. Every place the Dogon, or every place the Egyptians have a deity, the Dogon have a stage or a concept of creation. And when they're talking about that, they're talking about three things simultaneously. They're talking about how matter forms, how the universe forms, and how processes of biological reproduction happen. And so every symbol, they use a single progression of symbols here to simultaneously describe all three of those parallel processes. So any given symbol gets complicated because it has meaning for each of the three themes.
Are there other civilizations, other cultures that lead you to believe that we were visited by some kind of extraterrestrial being?
They're all over the world. These are the
cultures
that have the archetypes that Jung noticed and was trying to explain. His solution to it, being a psychiatrist, he came up with a psychological solution. There's an old joke that says if you visit a surgeon, you should expect a surgical solution to your problem. Well, same thing. Jung decided that the way these things were communicated was through a common psychology, a common memory, that it, sort of we're all connected under the covers to the same ideas, or that we're wired mentally to think of certain concepts in certain ways. There are certain signatures in this tradition. Any culture that uses a cubit for a unit of measure is connected to my tradition. Any tradition that imagines that there's a wheel or a spiral associated with Orion is connected to my tradition. There's a whole list of these that I can instantly tell if someone is using this as a reference in ancient times, that they were influenced by the same tradition.
Laird, some of the ancients did strange things, rituals, very bizarre things. Did you come across much of that when you put together this work?
Yes, I'll give you one really interesting example. I think you might be familiar with the ritual of the opening of the mouth of mummies that the ancient Egyptians did.
They would wrap the mummy, weird,
the dead person, and then they would open the mouth. And the symbolism was that material creation is said to be spoken. It rests on the idea of a deity speaking a word. And so you open the mouth of the mummy, and you allow the deceased soul to be reborn. Well, that's a more recent ancient version. There are reversals that happen about halfway through this tradition that cross cultures. And in the archaic form, they didn't open the mouth, they opened the top of the skull. Because in archaic times, the concept of ascension was that energy called Shakti emerges from the top of the skull when a person ascends. And so opening the top of the skull was to allow that same soul to not be reborn, but to ascend.
One of your other books I want to talk with you about tonight also is the Velikovsky Heresies. We'll get into that. That's always, we talked about that a couple, 2 years ago maybe?
Yeah, it's been a while. I like that book a lot too.
It's a classic. But back to the Dogon. So they're still around as a tribe.
Yes, they're about 300,000 people. It's a priestly
300,000? Wow. Okay.
They live primitively. They eke out a living through farming. They raise onions, and they produce really interesting artwork that they sell. And they've done everything they can to isolate themselves and sort of protect their tradition from outside influences.
Do they continue talking about visitations from the past? And then what happened? Why, if it occurred, why did they stop visiting?
Well, that's part of what we get into in the book also. This energy that scrolls between the universes, as we move along and we check references of other cultures to say, did any other culture have the same idea? Well, they did. The Kabbalists did, the Buddhists did, the Egyptians did, and so forth. And as you cross-check these references, you understand that it's not just energy that's scrolling between the universes, it's mass. Now, Einstein tells us that when something becomes more massive, its time frame slows down. Time gets slower for bodies that are more massive. And what that means is that the non-material universe, which is virtually massless, has to persist in a time frame that is ultra-quick compared to ours. And that's one of the pieces that is missed in traditional science about what's going on here between the quantum world and our the world we see, is that there's a huge difference in time frame between the two. Now, as that energy scrolls, it's sort of like an hourglass.
Mm-hmm.
And halfway through the cycle, the sand in the top of the hourglass is equal to the sand in the bottom of the hourglass, and those time frames equalize. Now, if you were to think of that process as, use a metaphor of a year for that process, the point at which that equalization happens is the equinox. Now, at the equinox, it becomes possible for theoretically possible for an entity on one side to move to the other side. Now, in ancient Egyptian times, the equinox was called Kepper, which is the dung beetle. It represents the concept of non-existence coming into existence. In Judaism, that would be Yom Kippur.
Yeah, okay, I get that.
And at the other equinox for Judaism, the holiday is Passover. And at the end of a Passover Seder, what they do is they open the door to allow a non-material Eliyahu to walk through the door. And so the indication here is that at the middle of this process, this 12,000-year cycle of this scrolling energy, that's a half cycle of the scrolling energy, that it becomes possible to move between the two domains.
Does the Dogon tribe talk about the futuristic things at all?
They talk about things that might seem futuristic to us because of the difference in the way time works in the two universes. One of the metaphors I use is we experience time like a cassette tape. We have to play it from the front to the back. The non-material experiences time more like a CD. They can skip around to any part they want to. And so there are concepts like such as that might seem futuristic to us. Also, the teachers of the Dogon were supposedly very capable. A lot of things they were considered like sorcerers in some of the things that they were able to do.
How spot on were they, the ancients, compared to where we are today?
Absolutely. I mean, you can take the Dogon references. The Dogon spell out how matter is forms. They begin with matter in its wave-like state, and they end with the equivalent of an atom. And they get the stages in between right, not just their descriptions, but also their drawings. But what that structure does is it establishes a credential for knowledge for the teachers, for us, because we're able to verify that whole stage from waves to atom. But they also talk about a much more fundamental structure down below, a series of stages that we're not yet in a position to directly verify. And that's what my book is about. It's tying those, what the Dogon say happened at that really rock bottom stage of matter, and try to analyze whether it's a reasonable description of what might happen, mm-hmm. and try to tie it to scientific correlations. Yeah.
Do you have any reason to believe that the Dogon tribe somehow made all this up?
There are people who think that they did. There's a Belgian anthropologist who restudied the Dogon in the 1980s. The French anthropologist who did a 30-year study said that it was a closely held secret tradition that the Dogon had. The Belgian went in for a few years to restudy it and said, look, I can't find any evidence of any of this stuff. The Dogon priests clearly made this stuff up to answer the persistent questions of this French anthropologist. The problem is that he didn't notice that the grand symbol of the Dogon tradition is a kind of a shrine, an aligned shrine, and it's a match for a Buddhist stupa. But the cosmology goes hand in hand with the shrine, and the Buddhists have the same cosmology. So unless we're willing to say that the Dogon priests casually invented Buddhism, they couldn't possibly have made it up. Buddhism is a known system, a recognized system all across India and Asia.
Laird, are you convinced that this tribe was visited by extraterrestrials who pointed out things like the Sirius star system?
I'm convinced that a non-material intelligence was able to find a way to act in a material frame and had a compelling motive to want to establish a framework for civilization for us that would preserve the memory of the existence of the non-material side.
And might they have gone to more groups other than the Dogons?
Yes, actually, what the Dogons say happened, and the Buddhists do also say happened, was they established basically a locale where instruction happened, and they brought groups to them. They brought groups 8 members at a time. This is the tradition you see all over the world of 8 ancestors who are quasi-mythical, who bring civilizing skills. Well, according to the Dogon and the Buddhists, those skills were deliberately instructed in a particular place, and then those students who had learned it went out and transmitted it to their own tribes.
Back in 1950, Emmanuel Velikovsky wrote a book called Worlds in Collision. Back in 2012, Laird Scranton wrote The Velikovsky Heresies. We'll talk about that, too, when we come back. And welcome back, Laird Scranton with us. His book is latest, Seeking the Primordial. We'll talk about some of his other works in just a second. If it was not extraterrestrial intervention with the Dogon tribe, what could it have been then, Laird? How could they have known these things?
Well, in the mindset of Samkhya, the non-material universe has perfect knowledge but an inability to act, and the material universe has imperfect knowledge with perfect ability to act. And that there are routine attempts made all the time to communicate knowledge from the non-material side to the material side through vivid dreams, through clairvoyance, through the odd behavior of animals, through what we see as daily coincidences, through divination, things like that. and that as time goes on, because of the scrolling energy, our ability to perceive the non-material changes. This is the yuga cycle concept in Buddhism. The idea that over time, during certain eras, we're much more attuned to the non-material side than we are in other eras. It runs in about a 12,000-year half cycle, and according to the way the system is portrayed, at the end of the cycle, it flips, that the universe that is more material is now becoming less material. The energy cycles the same way a Torah scroll does. In Kabbalism, it's actually referred to as the primordial scroll, exactly the same concept, the idea that over time we have energy and mass moving from one side to the other, and then it reverses itself.
Could knowledge have been given to them by telepathy?
It could have, but that's not the way the Dogon are describing it. The Dogon are talking about actual actions that are happening in a material
by brain. A physical presence.
Right, and they're concerned about what bad effects their presence is going to have on the Dogon tribes people and things like that. It's similar to their descriptions in the Bible, actually, when Moses receives the tablets and sees God on the mountain. There are cautions given to the Israelites not to approach too close to the mountain because of the potentially bad effects on them. This is a real-world physical event.
Emmanuel Velikovsky.
Emmanuel Velikovsky.
You've written a book on him called The Velikovsky Heresies. He was a Russian-born independent scholar, Jewish heritage, and he was a genius, and he wrote a book called Worlds in Collision back in 1950.
Right.
Which was very controversial. Tell me
right.
about that.
And it was hugely popular. Velikovsky was the first trained psychiatrist in Israel. He was a longtime friend and colleague of Albert Einstein. And as he was researching at Columbia University to write another book, he came across some ancient texts that he pursued and discovered that in cultures all around the world, Venus wasn't considered to be a planet until fairly recent times. That all of these cultures describe Venus as beginning its life as a comet. It doesn't even appear, isn't even mentioned until around 1500 BC, and all of the earliest mentions of it are as a comet. It was classified with the sun and the moon. It was so bright when you could see it move across the sky during the day. Now, my concept for the book was, I knew that there had been 60 years worth of research done, scientific findings done, since Velikovsky wrote. So I wanted to take those new findings and compare how did Velikovsky's theory hold up in terms of all the new Venus Express probes and things like that that have been sent out. Now, as it turns out, astronomers who study exo-universes, you know, the sort of exo-solar systems, the solar systems that are not our solar system, they've come around to a point of view that is almost a point-for-point endorsement of what Velikovsky said. They say that gas giant planets form first in a solar system, and then additional planets, rocky planets, form through collisions with the gas giants. And that's what Velikovsky said happened with Venus. And if that's the way the planets form, then we don't have any restriction on when they can form. It only happens whenever there happens to be a collision with a gas giant. So I was pursuing sources Velikovsky didn't have access to, and sources that were respectable and that did not have an axe to grind for or against him, and just trying to test each stage of his scenario. Could this be possible or not? Could Venus have been a comet? In these exosolar systems, they have direct evidence of planets that have cometary tails that look like comets. We actually have evidence on Venus of a remnant comet's tail that behaves just like a comet's tail. It points, gets brighter as Venus approaches the sun. It points away from the sun. Actually, when Venus makes its closest approach to the Earth, this tail extends out into space millions of miles all the way to the Earth and points at the Earth.
How did Venus get captured if it was a comet?
The suggestion is that what circularized its orbit was the effect of its comet's tail. We have examples of comets that originally had elliptical orbits that are now have circular orbits. But we can actually demonstrate that Venus's motions are changing still. Venus Express took some measurements The European Space Agency's probe took some measurements of Venus, and they discovered that the rotation of the planet has slowed 6 minutes since previous measurements had been made 12 years earlier. So there's some force acting on the planet that our astronomers have no sense of what's causing it, but it's slowing the rotation of the planet down.
Let's talk then about what could happen to Venus in the future. What are the possibilities? Will it stay where it's at? Will something bump it out of its orbit?
Venus, right now, there is one group of scientists who see things Velikovsky's way. These are the climatologists. And they say that with Venus, they found a time machine, because everything that's happening with Venus's atmosphere is what they've postulated happened with the Earth's atmosphere billions of years ago. So based on that, we can presume that what's going to happen for Venus potentially is going to be similar to what happened for the Earth, except for some differences in the way where it's located and how it orbits, how fast or how slowly it rotates.
Laird, what do you think happened to Mars?
Mars, there was a study done by Caltech that they ran hundreds of scenarios and decided that the damage they see on the crust of Mars was a result of a single planet impact. A planet-sized object hit it. And that's also precisely what Velikovsky said happened. The Caltech study concluded that that had happened millions of years ago, so I contacted one of the researchers and said, what makes us think it happened millions of years ago? And the researcher said, well, everybody knows there weren't bodies roaming around the solar system since that time that could have done it. So it's sort of a self-fulfilling statement that they don't actually have proof that it happened millions of years ago. They've just presumed it.
Is it dangerous that this has happened to Venus and it could happen elsewhere?
It's dangerous to the same extent when we saw an impact on Jupiter in recent years. If the body that hit Jupiter were big enough, it could create the scenario again where we have a planet-sized body roaming around in the plane of the planets, and that's very dangerous because there's a very high likelihood that any body in that plane is going to eventually intersect other planets. And you get a game of billiards sort of going on.
Well, it's a bizarre situation now. Do any of the extraterrestrials that might have visited, do they talk about this too?
There's no. Both the Egyptians and the Dogon have Venus calendars, and the first system of writing in China was developed to track the motions of Venus. Back in ancient times, Velikovsky said that cultures all over the planet were obsessed with tracking where Venus was, because in Velikovsky's scenario, there were some really bad eras in our history where Venus had made a close approach and caused havoc. When you have another planet-sized body come close to ours, you create volcanic activity, you cause fluctuations in the magnetic field, you can interfere with the way the moon works. After one of these eras, where Velikovsky says actually Mars, after being impacted by Venus, also made a close approach to the Earth, about 750 BC, we have hugely disruptive things happening. We have change in climate.
Mm-hmm.
We have a change in ion absorption of plants so that radiometric dating doesn't work across the boundary of 750 BC. Calculations for where the stars are don't work across that boundary. Anybody who tells you that they have verified alignments to stars that are before 750 BC, we don't have calculations that can actually verify that. There's no total eclipse of the sun that occurred prior to 709 BC that they can firmly verify.
What do you think of all this talk about Planet X, another planet somewhere out in the solar system, a Zachariah Sitchin theory?
Well, the motions of some of those planets out there very far out imply that there's something there they can't see. So I have no doubt that there's probably another planet out there that we're not seeing. Whether Sitchin was right about the nature of it, whether it presents any kind of a threat to the rest of us, I don't have information about.
Laird, how did you get involved in studying all this?
Sort of by accident. My wife had given me a book called Unexplained by Jerome Clark, and one of the chapters in this book talks about the Dogon mystery. How did they know about the Sirius stars? And I thought, Well, wherever that leads is going to be an interesting thing to research, and I started looking into it.
There are so many fascinating things on this planet that we're just discovering. Mysteries, ancient cosmology, as you've studied. It truly is remarkable, isn't it?
It really is, and so many different aspects to it. There's a whole community of researchers, alternative researchers, who are doing some pretty good work in trying to sort out some of it, taking an alternate view from what the traditional academic view is. But, you know, it's like a 3D picture. If you get two slightly different views on a subject, you get more of a three-dimensional view of what it really is.
Did you come across in your work anything from the ancients that dealt with the underworld or the spiritual world? You know, the Egyptians, they were obsessed with the spirit world. What about others? Did you find any?
The Egyptian concept of the underworld is actually treated on two levels at the same time, in Egypt and in ancient Greece and in some other cultures, the Dogon culture also, that on one hand it's treated like a cosmological concept or a mythological concept, but on the other hand it's also treated like an actual geographic locale on the planet, on the Earth. And I wrote a book called The Mystery of Scarabray that relates these descriptions to the locale north of Scotland, across the water from Scotland. There's an island that the earliest megalithic structures in the UK that looks to have been one of these locales the Dogon and the Buddhists talk about, where cosmology and farming were being instructed.
What about reincarnation? Did that come up with any of your research?
Yes, but there's not agreement about it between the traditions. Reincarnation is an active concept in the traditions of India. The Dogon say, the French anthropologist says that the Dogon flatly state that the only concept of reincarnation they have is one that pertains to DNA and the passing of traits of a person on to their offspring.
Indian sacred writings, ancient Indian sacred writings, talked about what could have been a nuclear war. Oppenheimer read it, and he was convinced that's what it was. May have helped him get his idea. What do you think of that?
Well, if you stop and think that all the technology we see right now has been created since 3000 BC, that's not a very long span of time compared to how long man has been on the planet. And so it's sort of not believable that it couldn't have also happened in a prior era. There certainly is talk about previous civilizations, possibility of high civilization, where the Egyptians talk about a first time, and the Buddhists talk about a first time a Buddha passed knowledge to humanity. The Dogon talk about a time when humanity was restored to culture. And so in the Dogon mindset, there's the implication that there were previous levels of high culture.
Yeah, and they are convinced that ancient India was devastated by a nuke war.
Well, I can see evidence of that, too. I'm not versed enough in that field of study to be able to prove it. But, again, it makes sense to me that if we can develop this much knowledge in this short a time, that there's no reason why it shouldn't have happened before.
Now, where would that weapon have come from?
Well, it would have come from people the same way that these ones have.
I mean, from ETs or from us?
No, I think from us. There are certain things you can point to that are likely the work of the teachers, not the not us. One of the comparisons I make is to a woodshop class. The project in a woodshop class might be to build a wooden bookshelf. Now, the teacher begins by bringing out the perfect example of the bookshelf that he created, he or she created. And then the students start making theirs, and the students' bookshelves are always inferior, noticeably inferior to the original one that was a sample. That's sort of what we see in ancient Egyptian culture, that all of the perfect stuff is there at first. Anything that's perfect, I say, is the work of the teachers, not the students.
Talking about ancients, Laird, when you read things in the Bible of Moses parting the Red Sea and things like that, what do you think really happened?
That's another tough one, because when you read the stories about Moses and the Exodus, which there is not overt evidence that's accepted yet. That there's evidence, but it's not traditionally accepted yet. So when you read those, there are reasons to think that we're looking at a myth. In ancient language, in the Egyptian hieroglyphic language and the language of this cosmology, words carry multiple meanings. Every word carries multiple meanings. The story of Moses leaving Egypt hits multiple meanings of the same cosmological words again and again and again and again. It looks like it's mythology. Now, the same thing happens in ancient China when they talk about ancient mythological emperors who did certain things. Those myths, those stories, center on these clustered meanings of particular words. And so someone like me looking back at it says, wow, that must be mythology, not history, because how could history play out in terms of these words?
God, wouldn't you love to get a time machine, Laird, and go back to these time periods?
I would. Now, the problem is that the history of my own work on these books has played out in terms of multiple meanings of cosmological words. That someone who looked back 500 years from now on the work I did is going to see that and is going to think, I can't tell whether this is history or this is myth, because these meanings shouldn't play out this way. A lot of it plays out in terms of my name. The key site in northern Scotland was discovered on the land of a person whose name was the Laird of Scale.
There you go. We're going to come back in a moment and take some phone calls with you, Laird, right here on coasttocoastam.com. So don't touch your dial.